Hello and welcome to the NDA podcast. It's always Media Thursday with me, Justin Pearce, the editor, and...
me, Andy Oakes, the publisher.
So, again, here we are. And as is traditional,
yeah,
I say to you, Andy Oakes, NDA publisher, what's been happening this week?
Well, it's... do you know what? It's taken me this long to get over jet lag, because we were in Miami last week. But we'll talk about Miami in a bit. We've just been... and classically on Media Thursday, we've just come from a lunch. My grumpy little gnome friend. You're very grumpy. He's really grumpy.
I'm not grumpy.
He's fucking grumpy. We have been at the Union Club, which in itself isn't unusual.
No.
But we have been at the Union Club with 30 of the finest of the publishing community for our Marketing the Marketers event. Now, we love doing these. Marketing the Marketers is something we're really, really quite proud of, because we take a section of the industry that people don't normally talk to, and we talk about it for lunch, but we talk about the issues they face. Because if you're a marketer for an agency or an ad tech or a publisher, you're not the star of the show.
No, these people, they're the ones who put forward their boss to speak at an event, or they put forward, you know, their CMO to talk to the press. So it's just really great getting their point of view and making them the star of the show, I guess.
Yeah. And... you assembled a fantastic panel today. So we had Quentin from Levi's, who's a fantastic, well-spoken Belgian.
Who's very, and well-dressed, obviously.
Well-dressed. Well, he had good jeans.
Very good jeans.
Jess from OMD, who is head of partnerships, I believe.
Yeah, she was amazing.
The lovely, gorgeous, lugubrious.
That's the great word.
Yeah. Gideon Spanio from Campaign.
And George Butler from Bauer. And why we love doing these events, as we said, it gives people that don't normally take front of stage place, but also we've got experts talking directly to the audience who want to engage them. So everyone in that room today, we had people from the Evening Standard and Sky, et cetera, all want Gideon to write about them. They all want Levi's to advertise with them. They all want to be on the plan at OMD. So just getting some great real-world thoughts and insight and case studies from people that is actually going to affect people in the audience. It's just amazing.
And I think the other thing is, look, we're going to be biased because we've been in publishing forever.
It's true.
Since 1993, as it turns out. Well, I have anyway, because I'm 900.
You're very old. I started about 6 months ago.
Yeah, I mean, I'm old, you're grumpy. We're all of the dwarfs today. You are really grumpy today.
I'm grumpy.
So grumpy.
I'm never grumpy.
Quite grumpy. But what I love about publishers is the collaborative nature of the way they do business. And if one of them has a problem, they're really quite happy to talk to other publishers, and they will help each other out. And I know it's different to ad tech, and I know it's different to agencies, but I genuinely enjoy myself in that room today. And that's not down to the
huge amounts of red wine you drank.
It was quite a lot of Malbec. Oh, so today is the proper first Media Thursday when I've genuinely had quite a bit of wine.
It's not Thursday.
That's the other thing I've got wrong. It's Wednesday, isn't it?
But I mean, Media Thursday is a concept. It's not a construct.
It's always really Media Thursday.
But what you say is true. And the room we're in now hosts the Alliance of Independent Publishers events, which you know, we're big friends and partners of, and we always host those events. And the same thing you see there, the collaborative nature of the publishing industry and the desire to sort of help raise the industry as a whole, especially as, you know, publishers have been competing against the big tech giants for a long time now, and the likes, you know, they've been sort of pushed down the programmatic supply chain, I guess, often. So
yeah,
they're coming together, their collective power is just a great thing to see.
I think they will have a similar problem. I mean, again, if you're talking to, for instance, as I was today, quite a lot of magazine publishers, and you're talking to the advertising people, then the nature of their role within a company has changed. Because in the old days, they would be the kings and queens of what they did, and now, actually, everything's shifting to a subs-based economy. And advertising is hard. Advertising is really hard, and it has been all this year. And, you know, you can see through all the bellwethers and walk reports this week.
Talking about bellwether.
Let's talk
about bellwether.
Okay.
So the bellwether was out today, in fact. And what was kind of fascinating, I thought about it, was for the first time they really picked out retail media as a sector.
Yes.
And we've been talking about retail media a lot this week in the office, and it's something you can't get away from. And what's kind of fascinating is that the definition of retail media is sometimes a bit woolly. So
that, I think, is absolutely, you're absolutely right there, because we've again come up with three definitions of retail media in the office this week. I mean, two of them are wrong, so that's probably why.
Yeah, that's one of the problems.
But talking to the companies involved, because we started calling them a different name, and we started with this alternative publisher market.
That's it, because publishers are, in the old days, publishers were Vogue and the FT and New Media Age. But nowadays, publishers...
There were only three.
There were only three. Publishers, Angling Times, I suppose.
Yeah.
Publishers nowadays can be TripAdvisor, or it can be National Rail Inquiries, mm-hmm. or it can be XYZ Stock Tips. It can be any company that provides content to a large, often very high-intent niche audience. So yeah, publishing is changing. And I think what Retail Media is fascinating is this idea of definition. We worked with Storefront, our partner, on a great round table a few weeks ago, published this week in India. Yeah. And Ollie Shea, the amazing Ollie Shea, omnichannel media director at Boots. You know, you ask him to give a definition of retail media, and retail media encompasses, from their point of view, everything from online retail media, which is getting all the attention at the moment, to in-store, to proximity, to...
Yeah, and that's the different thing, isn't it? Because, I don't know, I'm reading the industry press and I'm saying retail media is first-party data gathered by retailers, typically a big supermarket, something with Clubcast, blah, blah, blah. But yeah, whereas I think your definition there makes more sense.
And that's what makes it such a fascinating space. We're doing an event in 2 weeks, I think, with our lovely friends Media Rhythmics. And one of the panels is on retail media, and Dun Humby's speaking. And that's going to be another fascinating discussion, because you get in depth through retail media, the experts. There's so many issues around where the budgets come from, the fiercely held in-store marketing budgets against the digital marketing budgets. Where is this new incremental budget coming from? So it's a fascinating space. And again, retail media has been around forever. What's thrown into spotlight is basically programmatic, because now online retail media is via programmatic is now available to buy easily. But Nick Ashley, now MD of Tesco, wrote in LinkedIn just this morning, I think, you know, this IAB report focusing on retail media is a real turning point for retail media. It shines a really positive light in the sector and shows how much it's worth.
I think it's fantastic. I think it's, well, for one, it's a new thing to talk about. We've got a very short amount of time for our guests, right? So I want to talk about, what are you doing tomorrow?
Tomorrow I'm going to Manchester. We're going to Manchester a lot. You know, there's so much happening up there. And tomorrow we are doing a first for us with our lovely partner Newsworks, a quiz. And it's kind of loosely based.
No.
It's tightly based.
No, legally.
It's not based at all.
It's called...
It's nothing to do with a popular game show.
That's on the BBC.
Would I Lie to You? It's nothing to do with that.
Nothing to do with that at all.
No, because especially...
Could I Lie to You? Very different concept.
Yeah, nothing at all. But it's all about fake news, what's real, what's not. We've got an amazing panel of journalists from the Northern region. We've got an amazing host.
Well, we've got Charlotte Ives from the Times, Sunday Times. We've got Clay Wilson from Mail Metro.
And essentially what's going to happen is we've hired an amazing bar in the city, and we've got an amazing audience of media agency leaders and execs, and they're going to have to judge what's true and what's not from the headlines read out by our journalists.
Yeah, going to be a great event, great event. So if you are in a media agency and you're based in Manchester, get in touch. And the fact this won't be available...
Again, we always do this because it's not time travel. This will probably come out after the event.
If you can time travel, get in touch.
And also, when we do our next one, maybe ask if you can come.
Okay, that's fair.
That's done.
Well, and to be fair, it's been advertised a lot. If you've not got in by now, it's your own fault.
Though we've had loads of silence this morning, so obviously, you know, didn't go.
So let's talk about where we were last week before our new guest joins us.
Yeah, perfect segue. So last week we were in...
Miami Beach.
Why were you in Miami Beach?
It was a question I asked myself a lot last week. We were in Miami Beach for the first possible event, which we've talked about a lot. We've had Christian Mooker, the event organizer, on this podcast. But the first event came up, and it's self-described as the Davos of digital media marketing.
We've talked before about the fact, Christian invented Demexco, which shook up the events market. So there's high hopes for this event. We were a media partner. We went out for the duration. It was a really, really great show. I mean, we had some incredible speakers, and the engagement was really impressive. One of the most packed rooms, standing room only, and that was a fire department came, because it was too busy.
It was too busy.
Yeah, it was Elon Musk.
Yeah.
And Elon Musk is divisive against that saying. Personally, I found it quite interesting. The fact was he kept addressing the room, as in the advertising industry, saying, this is why I'm here. I'm here to talk. I'm here to, you know, reassure you. I'm here to get your budget. And that's something that he hasn't done that often.
Well, no, but he hasn't. And he has to do it because obviously, I mean, there were stories breaking last week on Semaphore and on Forbes about the fact that various brand representatives were very unhappy with the brand safety on Twitter. And had been talking, this was a, sorry, it's important to say that MMA were also big supporters of the possible event. And MMA contains some of the biggest marketers in the world. And they have their WhatsApp groups. And on those WhatsApp groups, they were saying, we don't think that Twitter is brand safe yet. And they were questioning whether the MMA should be involved with this. Now, Elon Musk can come on stage, do his thing, talk about his rockets. He was very good with the audience. I mean, come on.
He was extraordinary for the audience.
And yeah. It was a very odd thing to see, I think, for Brits in Miami to see people standing and whooping and cheering.
It was.
He talks about free speech and stuff.
It's very un-British.
He's a very, as you said, he's a divisive character. He's an engaging character.
He is. Yeah? He's engaging.
I don't know if he's a believable character.
No, but in the frame of Elon Musk talking to the ad industry, it was fascinating.
It was fascinating. I think, and I said this in the newsletter this week, I compared and contrasted his talk with Dr. Mark Grether of Uber Advertising.
Another great talk.
Which was very, very different. But here's the thing. Uber Advertising have already got £1 billion worth of ad spend.
I know. I mean, that's... You know, one of these companies, they've sprung up, and Uber Advertising is not new, but they're just sucking up talent from across the industry.
Some of the best people we know are going to work there.
Yeah, definitely. So it's a, and what... When you hear, you know, Dr. Mark talk about the possibilities of the Uber platform, the Uber community and the Uber technology, it's quite amazing what can happen.
Yeah. So in the newsletter, I do the contrast between if you're an agency, where are you putting your map? Where are you putting your dollars? Where are you putting your pounds? Are you going to put them on Twitter where big audiences could be terrifying? Uber, new audience, captive audience. I don't know. I know which way I've gone.
There was so much coming out of the Uber chat. One of the interesting stats I thought was he said that in each ride, Uber gets, was it 10% of the attention of the rider? And obviously attention is the most talked about new metric of the ad industry. And there's no denying, if we think of our own Uber experience, you're captive and you're kind of really interested in what's happening and going on, because you're normally you're meeting a friend, you're going to a restaurant, you're going to a club, you're going to work. You know, context is so important. And again, contextual advertising, flavour of the month, this couldn't be more powerful.
Absolutely. And we did spend a lot of time in Ubers last week.
Big Ubers.
It was the theme of the week. You don't get a small Uber in Miami, do you? You get a Yukon, an Escalade,
They're all quite hard to get in and out of.
They were really quite hard.
Yeah, much harder for you, obviously.
Well, I had to go in the back.
You like being in the back. I only worked out at the end of the week because I had to get out of these taxis. But anyway, we digress. But yeah, so it was a fascinating event. Let's see what happens. I mean, registration's open for next year already. It's been pushed hard. Great show, great speakers, great attendance. Probably the one thing that surprised me slightly, or maybe not, is lack of UK representation. It wasn't...
It's interesting. So you listen to Ari Paparo's podcast this week. It loves it. For an American audience to have a Cannes-style event on their shores, I think they loved it.
Yeah.
Now, for us, we can go and do that event. Being honest, we can go and do that event and an hour and 20 flight into Nice.
Yeah, that's a good point.
That being said, I think it was still cheaper to go to Miami.
And also, you get far more tacos in Miami.
Well, there is a reason you get far more tacos. It's because you don't understand how taco menus work. And you said, I'll have one of each.
Yeah, three tacos.
They had 15 varieties of taco on the menu.
Yeah, but details. Don't bother me with details.
I think now is a great time.
Well, look, we're talking about tacos and the amazing Miami. It was a great Greek. And talking about the lack of UK representation. And look, one of the people that was there from the UK, although who no longer lives in the UK, was the amazing Amy from Goodloop, who is joining us as this week's special guest. Amy.
Hello. Hi, thanks for having me.
How are you?
Thank you. Yeah, not too bad.
Amy's last time we see your Amy, we were much warmer climes.
Well, yes, exactly. I mean, almost too warm, I would say.
You could say that. Sorry, I've only just worked out where the camera is, so I'm just started looking this way. So you've been looking at the back of my head for quite a while.
We're using, just for the listeners' interest or not, we're using a different recording studio today, or different recording rooms. So that's very strange. I can hardly see Amy through the massive recording equipment.
And my head now. Sorry.
And your head. So Amy, we were just talking about Possible. Obviously, we were there last week and loved it. So what did you think of it?
I really enjoyed it, honestly. I thought it was an impressive event for the first time ever, you know, going to an industry event that's totally new. There is a little bit of uncertainty, right? And I think the caliber of people that it brought together and the caliber of conversation it provoked was, yeah, some of the best I've had in a while.
Amazing. What do you think of the speakers? And did you see Elon Musk?
I did, yeah.
What do you think? We're just talking about that.
So I thought that it was a real illustration of the power of the room that someone like Elon would appear, right? He is basically a celebrity at this point and has a huge amount of influence and power, especially now that he controls the platform that he uses to express that power. And I thought it was very telling that, you know, he was in that room speaking to us, speaking to the spend that we all collectively are in control of, and speaking to the way that advertisers can prop up or destroy these social platforms. I thought it was very impressive to hear him speak of freedom of speech, but not freedom of reach. I think that is a nuance to the freedom of speech conversation that isn't often addressed, but is really what our industry is all about, right? What gets promoted, what gets funded, that's what's important. Everyone's allowed to hurl insults as much as they wish, but they don't have a right to stand on a platform and have that broadcast or indeed profit from it. So I thought that was a nuance that he brought to the conversation that I appreciated. I think that there is still a lot of uncertainty around the safety of the platform and the role that brands play in that safety. You know, the extent to which if you appear in a feed next to negativity, is that negatively affecting the brand? Yeah, in a feed, maybe not. You know, like Elon's point was, I think he even said it, but jokingly, you know, you're always going to get negative feedback on the platform, right?
Yeah,
like humanity, you can't control or censor the good and the bad of human nature. And if a brand were to sponsor a post in a feed, I think his argument was it doesn't affect the brand's reputation. They're separate. So that was an interesting point.
Yeah, I mean, we both thought, I think it was kind of a masterclass. As you say, he was addressing the ad industry. He kept saying that point, and that's something he's not really talked about before. So I think probably I did him quite a lot of good in this community.
I'm still slightly sceptical that I thought he was showboating a bit. I thought he can't help himself that when he's goaded, he will go there. He will go. He'll, you know, Linda Yaccarino said to him, this was, I think, one of the most, I tweeted this straight from the event, when she said to him, oh, do the platform's rules apply to you then, Elon? And his face was thunder. And he didn't say anything for 10 seconds. He said, well, I'm pretty sure they do. It does. I thought, And it, you know, required a calm response. It required, what the trouble with Twitter at the moment is you cannot separate the actions of the founder from the way that the platform functions. And I think until you can do that, then I think there's always going to be a problem.
I agree. And actually, you know, I think the politics of the individual.
Sorry, not the founder, the owner.
yeah, the owner. In most cases, I would be an advocate of divorcing the two, right?
Yeah,
the politics of an individual is different from the organization they represent. But in the case where he is literally, you know, in control of the algorithms and the amplification that happens, indeed, we've seen his own tweets get amplified or preferenced. I think that the politics and the ethics of the individual have to absolutely be intrinsically linked until the point that we are shown that they aren't. And another thing that made me slightly concerned, because I think you're right, like we should absolutely approach this with a level of healthy skepticism. The other thing that concerned me about his session was he framed the traditional news media as competitors.
Absolutely, yeah. Yes.
And in response to a question about that BBC journalist, you know, and some of the controversy where traditional news media has been negative about Twitter and his behaviour, his response was, well, they're the competition, so obviously they're going to be negative about me.
Yeah.
Mm. And sowing seeds of doubt about free, open journalism feels very dangerous. A huge red flag.
That was a theme he returned to a few times through the talk.
He did.
He said, well, you know, why should I have to... I don't understand why media companies should have special treatment on the platform, because who pays for that? You know, who's paying for them? Who's building their opinions? I thought, well, it's... No, he misses the point
of...
It was a very direct attack on the press. It was probably fueled by his as Amy said, he'd had the recent interview with the BBC. I thought he didn't handle that very, very well. And I thought, to be fair, I thought NBC's Linda Yaccarino was superb.
She was excellent.
She kept calling him out. She kept pulling him back.
Yeah.
Because it would have been very easy to do a soft pedal on that and let him off and let him do what he wanted, which I think he expected was what...
Yeah, totally.
You could see he didn't expect the tough questions.
Totally. Yeah. He wasn't antagonised, but he wasn't left off the hook.
No, exactly that. So look, Amy, let's talk a bit about you in the US. When did you move out there? 6 months ago, 8 months ago?
I moved Friday the 13th of January.
Of course.
So I'm
good work, Amy.
Of course. So how's it going? And what, I guess we talked a bit when we were over there, what are the differences of the industry in the States to over here, do you think?
It's going well. Thank you. Yeah, so we've been running business in the US here for about 2 years, but obviously it's all been on Zoom from our kitchens in London. So this year was sort of our first official US office. I opened our New York office in January, and I've been hiring and building the team here in the States. So I've been talking to a lot of Americans and hiring a lot of Americans. There's so many differences. I've been floored at the differences, honestly. I think the shared language makes you a bit naive and complacent. For example, Good Loop focus in on helping brands buy media that is ethical, sustainable and responsible. And what that means in these two markets is actually so different. In Europe, there is a very, very mature conversation around sustainability in media. You know, I think it's probably coming on 2 years old. You know, Avnet Zero was founded in the UK. Purpose Disruptors was founded in the UK. Most agencies have now signed up to and started taking steps towards Avnet Zero. You know, the conversation has reached a level of maturity where we are thinking about actions, not just education. Whereas here in the US, I would say the exact level of progress has been made, but on the diversity point, there is a laser focus on funding and representing diverse and underrepresented voices. There is a big drive to make sure there is a percentage of media spent on Black-owned publishers in particular. And so it's almost like the inverse. In Europe, we are ahead on sustainability, behind on diversity. And here in the US, they're ahead on diversity and behind on sustainability.
Amy, I ask this question a lot at the moment, especially given the economic situation we all find ourselves in. Are people still willing to buy ethically and not focusing more on performance? Can both be done? Or is buying ethically more of a good times luxury than it is than possibly in harder times?
It depends how you frame it, right? I mean, fundamentally, if I take those two pillars as a lens, on the diversity piece, you know, the Black consumer market here in the US represents multi-billion dollars of worth of spend. The Hispanic market equally is a huge under-targeted demographic, and increasingly, you know, the generation coming up behind us is the most ethnically diverse generation in history. So there is a huge business imperative there that isn't about, you know, a luxury and good times. It's really quite a savvy business strategy in tough times. And then on the sustainability, it's the same narrative. Your sustainability is fundamentally about reducing waste, whether it's reducing the plastic in our rubbish bins, reducing the clothes in a landfill, or reducing the amount of waste in your programmatic buying. The principle is the same. The less you waste, the better it is for your planet. So increasing viewability, managing your supply path optimization, getting more money direct to the publisher. These things are good for business. They are they're good for the advertising experience, and they're also good for the planet.
Now, what we didn't have had an event. We just come from an event we ran, and on the panel we had OMD and Levi's. And I asked about sustainability. It was a room full of publishers, and it was about how they can market themselves better. And we were talking about sustainability, and I was asking, how important are the sustainability credentials of publishers now when you're looking to do deals with them? And both OMD and Levi said, incredibly important. And I asked, are we at the stage yet where people won't get the business? And they both went, not yet, but almost. So are you not seeing that sort of thing happening in the US? But on the flip side, are you seeing this happen in the UK? The fact that sustainability credentials of an agency or a publisher means they could win or lose business?
Absolutely, I am. And I think that we will see an evolution from carrot to stick. So at the moment, the big focus has been on education, on encouraging those first movers, on making sure that there is competitive advantage for the businesses and the brands that are leaning in and showing their commitment above and beyond. You know, a great example of this is OpenX, you know, an impressive SSP who have gone deep into their internal operations and become not only the first advertising business, but the first global business to reach their net zero targets.
Okay.
Phenomenal success, and you know, and that's got them on stages, that's got them celebrated, that's got them, you know, partnerships like the one that we're working on them with. Increasingly, we will see less carrot and more stick. Increasingly, this will become, rather than a differentiation point, it will become a reason to lose business. It will become a reason why money flows in the opposite direction. And I think Levi's are actually a great example of this debate, because they are a brand who consider sustainability, I kind of think of it as like the iceberg, right? The below the water, which is all the media you buy, the electricity you use to run your ads, the supply chain, your SSPs, your DSPs, your creative weights, your file formats, all of the stuff a consumer's never going to see, but is fundamental to your environmental footprint. And we actually work with Levi's. We run kind of carbon neutral ad buys for them. And then there's the above the iceberg, there's the tip that the consumer sees. And that's where I think Levi's are a great example of a brand that has created ownable differentiation in the space. You know, their denim uses 90% less fresh water. So they can talk about saving the planet, and that's something that really is above and beyond any singular jean company. But when it comes to water saving, that's where they can authentically and with authority carve out differentiation. So I think it's both. I think it's both a, you know, a hygiene factor that will make you lose business, but it's also something that you can find those ownable pockets where you can create real differentiation and loyalty.
Do you think there are any, because one of the problems with things such as diversity and sustainability, purpose, is that often it can be seen as lip service, and people jump on bandwagons and not go through with what they're saying on conference stage, on social media. Do you think that's still an issue in sustainability, or we move beyond that now? In the frame of digital advertising in particular, rather than the other.
Sure. I think it is always going to be one of the most pressing issues of this debate, because it's easy to set targets. I just wrote a piece actually sort of delving a bit deeper into what these targets mean, because we're starting to hear a lot of it. You know, Ad Net Zero, which is a collective industry commitment to be net zero by 2030. Diageo have said they're going to be net zero by 2040. Unilever have said 2039, just to be annoying. you know, we've got Volvo have said that they'll have net carbon neutrality by 2050. Like, the statements are out there. And now we have to go from making targets to achieving them. And I don't think we yet have enough communication and clarity to help make sure that businesses are held really accountable. There was a study came out recently showed only 12% of corporate targets are on track to be hit.
12%? So, wow, okay.
Yeah, it's quite phenomenal.
Yeah.
So I think it is the number one problem that we're going to face. But I also, you know, in this research I did, I also found that companies that set targets are reducing at a significantly faster rate than companies that don't set targets. And we all know in our own lives, right? If I give myself a target of like achieving this thing by the end of the day, like it's more likely to get done. So corporate voluntary targets are crucial, and setting them and helping educate everybody who works within a business to know what setting them means, like I'm all for, but it's just understanding them enough so that we can call it out when it doesn't happen. I think we haven't quite got there yet.
I always think that's interesting with International Women's Day, when you see the claims made by various agencies about, oh, we're committing to doing X by this time next year. And it's been said so many times, someone needs to keep a register.
Yes.
Someone needs to come back next year and say, hey, did you do what you said you were going to do?
But you know, a great hack on that exact point is that Twitter bot, that every time a company used the hashtag International Women's Day, the Twitter bot would look up their gender pay gap.
Ooh.
And just retweet it.
Well, that's something we'll be looking into.
I mean, gender pay gap is such an interesting area of discussion, because whenever I'm interviewing C-suite of ad tech companies, I went through a spate of asking them, you know, what's your gender pay gap? And the number of MDs you couldn't tell me was quite stark. And yes, there's reasons for this, and not every company has to publish it, et cetera, et cetera. But yeah, it's an area that often it's easy to talk about, but actual real action falls far behind.
Yeah, ours is 25%, and it's high. And I'm a female founder. Like, it's something that
you're
I'm
obviously
not
paying yourself not enough, then.
That's what I'm hearing here. Yeah, but it's also like, I think, you know, now I'm running a business, I am so much more aware of like the systemic factors that come into a gender pay gap. You know, so many of my brilliant female colleagues have had to take time out for family commitments. And then there's sort of the time lag of what that does to your career.
Absolutely.
So from our perspective, you know, we track and we publish our gender pay gap every year. On International Women's Day, I posted it on LinkedIn, because I think that transparency is key, and it is a number all the leadership should know. But actually, rather than trying to address it directly, what we're trying to do is really encourage more equal parental leave. So we've now offered, we have equal parental leave for men and women in the company. So if you become a father through biological or adopted, then you get 4 months paid leave. And so just trying to encourage the men that, you know, we can control to shoulder the equal responsibility that can hold women back.
It you're totally right. The systemic thing is hugely important. And although I only found out what our gender pay was yesterday, actually.
What is it?
It's 1% in favour of women.
That's good.
Yeah. Oh.
Good.
Which, well,
wow. they're better.
They are better than us men in our company. We've realised this a long time ago that exactly. We're holding the company back.
Totally.
Yeah.
I mean, I say many of you, but probably both.
But, I mean, mainly me, yes.
So, Amy, we're sort of coming to the end of time-ish, but let me end up asking you, you know, you're in the States now, you're running one of the most impressive companies in our space, doing really amazing work, not just in our industry, but on a society-wide basis. I mean, that completely. So what are you most looking forward to in the year ahead? And especially, I mean, just because we've been talking about possible where we all met last week and we'd been at an event. So in the industry terms, what are you most looking forward to? Is Cannes still going to be a highlight or, you know, what?
Are you going to Cannes?
I am going. I am. And last year I was in the judging panel, so I was in a dark, windowless room for all 4 days.
Yeah, you did a very bad thing there, Amy.
This year I can't wait to not do that. I am looking forward to Cannes. You know, I went to South by this year, and 2020, it was Sorry, no, not 20. I've literally forgotten what year we're in. 2022.
I did this yesterday.
Oh my God, like the last couple of years are just one lump. So 2022, it was back in inverted commas, and it was there, but it was a bit weird. This year, it was back. Like, it was busy. It was exciting. It felt like, and also there's more innovation. Like last year, the biggest thing everyone was talking about was NFTs. Mm. And, you know,
nobody cares.
I see their place. I see some interesting innovation and some interesting stuff we can learn. But like, oh my God, the amount of metaverse bros was just too much. And this year, there's true innovation. ChatGPT is going to, has already actually changed how we all operate every single day. You know, this idea of a chief prompt officer, this new role that's like a professional AI prompt writer, because what you input into the AI is actually the most valuable thing a human can do. We're even using it in our response to client briefs now.
Really? To tell me a bit more about that. So what, how are you making it work?
Yeah, well, so many of our clients come to us wanting to, you know, understand what drives ethical consumption, or what are the trends around, I'm trying to think of some live briefs, like we're doing a campaign at the moment that's all around celebrating women in STEM. So what are some of the trends? What are some of the like social media hashtags? What are some of the conversations that surround that topic of women in STEM? Because this brand we're working with wants to fund you know, supporting getting more young girls into science and technology. ChatGPT, we put in like, what are some of the trends? And literally it comes back with, and you can even say, you know, write it in the style of a response to a client brief. And frankly, you can copy paste it.
Wow.
It's supplementary, you know, it doesn't replace the humans, but it's just that the power of that tool. So that felt like, at South By there was this germ of it. Now we're on version 4 and, you know, and starting to update some of the data, because obviously I think version 3 was only up until 2021.
Yeah, it was.
So now we're starting to play with much more powerful versions, and it's really just an illustration of, like, you know, that theory where there are these like seismic shifts in technology, and then there's like incrementals, and then there's another seismic one. And for a while, we all thought it was like Internet of Home, where like our fridges could tweet. This is actually one. This is actually one. Okay. And it's happening this
year. Wow. Amazing.
Amy, we really look forward to seeing you in Cannes.
Yeah, me too.
Come join us on a boat. You won't have to blag your way onto our boat, because your blagging skills last week were quite legendary. It was a delight to hear how you just breezed into parties. So you won't have to blag your way onto a boat. There will be an open invitation to you.
As
oh
ever.
No, come on. I like a challenge.
All right. You're not allowed on our boat.
You can't come on. That's it. Well, Amy, look, thank you so much. It's always amazing talking to you. Great to see you last week in the real world, and great to have you on a podcast today. So thank you so much. Can't wait to see you again.
See you, Amy.
Bye, guys.
Thank you.
Bye. The amazing Amy Williams. She's definitely one of the best in our industry.
Isn't she?
Yeah, she's amazing.
She was so much fun last week.
Yeah,
and
she's amazing. And I think, yeah, I do love her. And I do think we're
finish the sentence
her.
Quickly.
I loved her sort of description of, this is the defining technical leap.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
it's
definitely.
Happening this year. It's happening this year.
Yeah.
Without a doubt. So let's wind this podcast up. It's been another...
I think this has been one of our best. I think we should drink more wine before more podcasts.
I think you're right. Yeah. Well, I think it just leaves me to say it's... goodbye from me, but it's also goodbye from
me,
Andy Oakes, publisher. Thank you so much for listening. Goodbye.